Our fascination with estates are that they are achievable castles. We sit in awe of how large and grandiose they are, how immaculate and pristine the details that create its structure. And we love how we can actually achieve it. We love estates and mansions because it shows how our dreams can be achievable. We can reach something that remarkable. But we never really think about the truth that behind those doors can be a sinister story. My name is Ellie, and welcome to Tales of Two Cities podcast.
Hello?
Welcome.
This is Tales
of Two Cities.
In 1889, a three-story brick mansion was built by architect Frank Edbrook in Denver, Colorado. Edbrook is famous for having built the Brown Palace Hotel, the Central Presbyterian Church, the Tabor Opera House, and the Sisters of Loretto Academy. The mansion was built in my favorite style, a craftsman plan, with additional space for office rental. The design is robust and detailed, representative of the contemporary arts and crafts movement. The house features massive masonry and walls, and chimneys paired with steeply pitched roofs, similar to English country homes. There's also a large porch and formal facade facing the street, and the front wall is tall and narrow with brickwork. It was constructed in what is today known as Millionaire's Row, near the Colorado Capitol. The 6,635 square foot home was constructed for $15,000. That's more than $465,000 today. William Riddick Whitehead built the home. He was born in 1831 to a wealthy family in Suffolk, Virginia. He studied medicine in the United States before moving to Paris to study French. He then moved to Vienna, where he volunteered as a surgeon in the Russian army during the Crimean War. He spent numerous years in Europe before settling in New York to continue his career as a surgeon. When the Civil War began, he returned to his Southern heritage and served as a surgeon for the Confederate Army. In 1872, following the end of the Civil War, he moved to Denver in the hopes that it would help his wife, who was in poor health. He quickly rose to become a leading Denver local. He was elected to the Denver City Council in 1874. And soon after, he became the chairman of the Denver Board of Health. He was a leader of the local Denver medical community, and during his life, he published in many medical journals and was elected the president of the Denver Medical Association in 1877. It was in 1889 that he commissioned the construction of his mansion. He was already well established in Denver and would live in that mansion until his death in 1902. The mansion was so grand, it even served as the state governor's home for 2 years, during the turbulent tenure of Governor James Peabody. Thus, the mansion's name today, the Peabody-Whitehead Mansion. Following the mansion's occupancy as a home, several restaurants have utilized the space, and others have used the mansion for office space in the 1990s and today. The mansion is known as one of Denver's most haunted mansions. It is reportedly home to a dozen or more spirits. The current owners, Malbert Properties, have reported falling books, numbers appearing on calculators that are in locked offices, while others have stated their desks are covered in disheveled papers after leaving it tidy the night before. Faint cries of an infant can be heard when no earthly infants are in the building. What makes these hauntings interesting is how early they began. It's rumored that immediately after construction, when Dr. Whitehead and his family moved in, it started. Some have suggested that it's Whitehead that brought the spirits with him. His time working as a doctor in one of the bloodiest wars in the country, the Civil War, caused these hauntings. He was the doctor to many men who were dying in the battlefield, and he also had many soldiers who passed after his surgical treatment. among one of the most famous to undergo surgery at the hands of Dr. Whitehead, was Confederate soldier General Thomas Stonewall Jackson. It suggested that the souls struggling to deal with their own deaths in the war followed Whitehead from New York to Denver. But it wasn't just Whitehead. There are also spirits associated with Governor James Peabody, who brought his own chaos to the home. Peabody, a Republican businessman from Cannon City, was elected governor of Colorado in 1903. At this time, Colorado did not yet have an official governor's mansion, so Peabody set out to find a fitting home in Denver. He took residence during his term in office, but it's believed that he only lived in the home from 1903 to 1904. During his two terms, there were many violent strikes in the state's mining communities. There was strong support both for and against the unionization of Colorado miners. Peabody declared martial law on the striking miners and made a powerful enemy. There were two unsuccessful attempts to assassinate him, including one attempt that included a planted bomb near the curb of the home. The other was a planned shooting by Harry Orchard, a suspected henchman for the Western Federation of Miners. The miners' strike was a huge part of Peabody's tenure. In fact, it was such an important part of Colorado politics, it was the principal issue in the 1904 election between Peabody and Alva Adams, who had served two previous terms. Adams won the election and was inaugurated, but political intrigue resulted in the Republican legislature declaring that Peabody, before resigning on March 17, 1905, was to be succeeded by Lieutenant Governor Jesse F. McDonald. Perhaps those who were striking for better working conditions found the man responsible and decided to stay with him and his home for a while. As mentioned before, the home has been transformed and utilized in many ways over the more than 100 years that it stood. In the mid-1950s, the mansion was transformed into apartments before being remodeled into a restaurant and nightclubs. Reports of ghosts increased in the 1970s, when restaurants such as Carriage Inn, Bentley's, La Scala, the Bombay Club, the BBC, Albee's, and Senior Peabody's occupied the space. These owners all reported incidents of paranormal activity. Trays mysteriously tipped over, dishes and glasses broken suddenly, and on their own. Occasionally, customers and employees alike reported seeing knives, forks, even pots and pans flying in the kitchen and dining areas. The disconnected service bells and phone would ring incessantly, and flashes of lights from the disco ball during the stint as a nightclub were common. But it wasn't just disco lights. Another owner was frustrated by a flickering chandelier. The manager called an electrician to fix the issue, though after studying the wiring, the electrician said that he couldn't do anything, because it wasn't actually connected to any electrical wiring in the home. In 1983, an entrepreneur opened a bar at the mansion, calling it Spirits on Grant Street, in the hopes that he could capitalize on the hauntings. He even decided to open on Halloween night. But the business did not last. Within 1 year, it was closed. The most famous tale from that time was that of a ghost who poured a bottle of beer down the shirt of a cook who had made a homophobic comment. Of course, after a time of near constant haunting through various owners, psychics and supernatural investigators decided to visit the home. This research brought more information on these hauntings. One investigative team reported a young woman named Eloise, or Ella. She haunts the second floor. They believe she may have died after being abandoned by her fiancé. Some visitors have reported her hovering in mirrors and men often seeing her in the men's restroom. Some argue that the basement is the creepiest location in the house. There are a few known spirits in the basement, including one of a waitress who hung herself there with an apron one night after closing. Another spirit is on the first floor in the women's restroom. It's believed that this is the spirit of an older gentleman whose cherry-scented pipe tobacco haunts the room. Visitors mention the nauseating cherry odor comes and goes regularly. Perhaps the creepiest tale of the mansion is an alleged murder that would have happened in the 1970s. Travel Channel's Ghost Adventure came to investigate, though despite my obsessive research, I found nothing to substantiate the claim, though a different grisly murder in the Peabody Mansion in Massachusetts did pull my attention, but that's for another episode. The most tangible and frightening tale of the Peabody Whitehead Mansion is a single image captured from the porch during a haunted history tour. The image was taken with a cell phone, and it is poor quality, but when the photo is lightened, there's a dark, creeping figure hanging over the railing. Perhaps a miner still looking to take out Peabody? A Union soldier hoping to hurt Whitehead? Or another tortured soul locked in this property from the many residents over the years? We may never know.
Hollywood seems to be a city where people love it and love to hate it. We love our favorite stars' successes, but we also love their failures. It makes us feel good. It makes us feel like we are better than them. That's why we watch TMZ. It's why we look at sensationalist headlines. It's why we watch reality shows. Maybe it feeds into our jealousy, or our, quote, hater mentality, end quote. Or maybe it makes us feel okay to mock. Maybe that's why Hollywood is so synonymous with scandal. Because we want their success and their failures to go hand in hand. We want both. We just don't know, and we just don't want to admit it. Let me tell you about the Greystone Mansion. Ned Doheny came from celebrity royalty, son of Edward L. Doheny, the oil tycoon that owned most of Los Angeles and parts of oil companies in Mexico. Edward Doheny was the first inspiration of the main character for There Will Be Blood. He was also the economic rival to John D. Rockefeller, the name you usually associate with buildings and New York dancers. His son Ned went to the best schools and was given spoiled upbringings. However, that never changed his heart, and he was described as a boy with a heart of gold. Ned was given the 46,000 square foot house in 1928. Beautiful terrace gardens surround the estate, scattered with trickling fountains, overgrown paths, and eye-catching nooks. The home cost over $4 million to build, which is about $50 million of today's money. At the time, it was the most expensive building to build. You have certainly seen the mansion in films and TV. Its grand staircase in the entrance was filmed for the set of Spider-Man, The Big Lebowski, and Gilmore Girls. It was and is the essence of extravagance, which surprises most people when they discover its mystery and murder history. On the night of February 1929, Ned's childhood friend and assistant, Theodore Hugh Plunkett, used his key to enter the mansion. When Ned was courting Lucy, he met Hugh. Hugh worked at the Smith family's gas station. They instantly became great friends, and soon Hugh became one of the Doheny's main servants, acting as chauffeur for the entire Doheny family. Both men served in the Great War. When they returned from service, Hugh acted as Ned's personal secretary, often traveling with him as he became more and more involved with his father's businesses. They were more than friends. They were brothers. Hugh said hi to Ned's wife Lucy, and was seen by several servants. He went upstairs to one of the Greystone's many spare rooms, where he met with Ned and locked the door. Lucy did not think anything. Hugh was Ned's best friend, and someone that was close to the family. He had a key to the house, and he was a trusted friend of the family. She didn't think anything bad about the situation until she heard the gunshot. At first, she did not call the police. That's something you don't do when you're the elite. She also didn't instinctively go into the room to see what happened. She instead thought she could fix the problem. She called the family doctor. When the doctor and Lucy finally knocked on the door, Hugh answered the door with the gun in hand, extremely agitated. He went back into the room, slamming and barring the door. Then, there was a second gunshot. Once the room was pried open, they found both men lying on the ground dead. It was initially labeled as a murder-suicide, but certain key factors kept the media suspicious. According to Dr. Fishbaugh, he said, "I received a call at the Hollywood Playhouse from my maid at 10:30 p.m. and was told to go to the Doheny home immediately. Upon my arrival there, one of the watchmen, those name I do not know, let me into the house. As I entered, Mrs. Doheny was standing in the middle hallway, approximately 8 feet from the door, and greeted me. She said her husband was in the guest room of the first floor, to the left of the hall leading up from the first entrance. Both Mrs. Doheny and I started down the hall, side by side. A door, which partitions the hall, was slightly ajar. I saw Plunkett walking towards it. 'You stay out of here,' he shouted at me and slammed the door shut. I then heard a shot. 'You go back,' I told Mrs. Doheny, and she returned to the living room, which was about 75 feet away from the guest room. I pushed the door open and saw Plunkett lying on his face opposite the door of the bedroom where I later found Mr. Doheny. Plunkett, to the best of my recollection, was fully clothed. The door to the bedroom was open, and when I looked and I saw Mr. Doheny lying on his back, a chair overturned between him and the bed. Like I said before, even though it was initially labeled murder-suicide, key certain factors kept the media suspicious. Like, for example, Hugh, the friend, was shot in the back of the head. If Ned died first, how did Hugh die? Lucy claimed that her doctor found the bodies around midnight, but the police were called at 2 a.m. When the police came home, both bodies were moved. Lucy explained that the reason that they were both moved was because they were trying to revive the men. When the other witnesses were questioned, their statements seemed rehearsed. Despite this suspicious evidence, the police ruled the case as a murder-suicide. There were some theories on what had happened. One was that Ned was the one that called the doctor, not Lucy, to come calm Hugh down. Another is that Ned and Hugh were lovers. Jealousy or love caused them to either get shot or commit suicide. Either Ned killed himself or Lucy killed both of them. The bodies of Ned Doheny and Hugh Plunkett were buried close to each other at Forest Lawn, a secular cemetery. The Doheny family, however, was Catholic, giving massive donations to the Catholic Church for years. If the Dohenys were Catholic, why would they let their son get buried in a secular cemetery? Does that connect to the relationship or the suicide? Both would cause the family to believe that Ned was unfit to be buried in a Catholic cemetery. The last theory is probably the most probable one. At the time of the two deaths, the biggest scandal in American history was currently under trial. For those that do not remember the Teapot Dome scandal from high school history class, here is a brief version of it. The Harding administration was leasing federal oil reserves to the oil company at a low cost. Ned's father, Doheny Sr., had been tried in court for his involvement in the scandal. He was accused of bribery to persuade a member of Harding's cabinet to lease federal oil. Ned and Hugh were also implicated in the scandal. While the Gothic quarters bring a sense of marvel and wonder, the Greystone Mansion carries with it the literal and figurative ghostly figures. Some report seeing a man in a black suit. Others have seen a ghostly figure of Lucy Doheny. Near the end of her life, Lucy would dress up every day and wait, handbag sitting patiently on her lap. What was she waiting for? Some believe that she was waiting for Judgment Day, claiming that she felt guilty about whatever happened that night so long ago. That is probably why, even after her death, people have seen her and smelled the faint smell of lilac in her wake.
Thanks for listening. We appreciate each of you, and we love hearing from you. So hit us up on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or email us at talesofthenumber2citiespodcast@gmail.com. And please rate, review, and subscribe on the listening platform of your choice. We're on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, YouTube, and Spotify. We're a bi-weekly podcast, but if you just can't wait for the next episode, head over to our Patreon and pledge for mini episodes and bonus content. And it's the holiday season. If you're in the giving spirit, help us out by purchasing some of your gifts from our shop at TeePublic. They have great sales all month, and we have rad designs, so check them out. Again, we appreciate each of you. Thanks for listening. Until next time.